Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in communications with classes in online journalism, digital video production, interviewing, and crisis communications. strose.edu/grad.
And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
It's The Media Project with the professor, the publisher, and the editor coming to you from Albany, New York, in the studios of Northeast Public Radio, where one of our participants just concluded a letter that he wrote by saying, with all due respect, you're full of...
You're full of it.
Yeah, good.
I think it's universally understood what that it is.
We think so. Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, is here, along with Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Nice to see you again.
Wonderful to see you, sir. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany. We are here to offer you some analysis, insight, hopefully, and commentary on the media issues of the week. We start with a letter, a piece of mail from a listener, Jeannie in Albany, apropos our conversation last week about some of the phrases, you know, the trite phrases that we use in journalism.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She says, my least favorite journalese phrase is, out of an abundance of caution. As in today, Governors Cuomo and Christie incarcerated all people who traveled to Africa during the past 3 years in an attempt to spread the Ebola virus out of an abundance of caution. Am I wrong to interpret that phrase as out of fear from the electorate if I screw this up? So I don't know if that's journalism that actually uses that phrase or...
Everybody uses it.
Yeah, it gets around.
But it's been recently, it's tied into Ebola, which as Rex and I discussed a few weeks ago, was overplayed by the media. And now all of a sudden it's disappeared. You see virtually nothing on TV and radio or in the press on Ebola.
Well, I think Jeannie is terrific. We've heard from her, I believe, before. But Garrison Keillor has it right when he goes after the Association of English Majors.
You know, I hear from readers who are upset by sentence construction that is perfectly fine.
Of course.
It is, in fact, in English, it is smart to wisely split infinitives. You hear what I did there? And it isn't a terrible thing even to end sentences in prepositions. You remember the phrasing of Winston Churchill, who said that there are some of these things up with which I will not put. and that is the ridiculous construction you get to if you follow the old rules of English teachers, which really need to be adjusted to contemporary reality.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I have to tell you, I had an English teacher in high school who obviously I now know had an acid reflux problem. And so therefore, he had a lot of he ate a lot of Tums. And the Tums, spittle, came on the corner of his mouth.
This is getting really interesting, don't you think, Harold?
So, no, I'm telling you a story because every time I get one of these letters, I think... Brings me back to the English professor and, you know, and the stuff. Listen, I'm a columnist. I love to write in the people's vernacular. I mean, I want to connect. So what do I want to do?
To please the little people. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Did you say that?
Well, but you know, I like.
Did you say something about little people?
Potentially disgusting as that description of the spittle was, I like the fact that it was in fact descriptive. You know, I used to try to tell reporters many years ago, you know, if you go to an event, try to inject some color that could be relevant to the story. And we always had this famous line: a late mayor in Kingston, and the line was Mayor Koenig, comma, who smokes Luckies, comma. I don't remember if that story made it relevant, but it did add a little something to the story.
That's true. It is important to differentiate between detail and relevant detail. Actually, I covered a mayor. My first full-time newspaper job when I was 21 years old was in Rensselaer, Indiana. farming community in the northwestern part of the state. Where there was a mayor named Emmett Eager. He went by the name of Tim. And
I'm so sorry. I missed. Maybe my bad ears. Emmett Caesar
Eager.
Eager.
Oh, Eager.
Emmett
as
Eager.
Eager to please. Eager.
Now I think I know
Indeed.
Where this is going.
Here it is. And he always had a little bit of chaw, a little chewing tobacco. Uh-huh. And you would be sitting in the mayor's office, a small space in the back of the police headquarters, and he'd be talking to you, and then he would lean over and open his top desk drawer and spit into it. Sorry,
that's
I just went
funny.
Off mic there.
No, that's
leaning
funny.
Over and spitting into his desk drawer.
Did you report this?
No, it would have been a relevant detail.
That was the thing. It's because who smokes Lucky's? It drew a picture as the mayor was speaking.
Who he is.
The guy spitting out his Tums, whatever it was he was doing.
No, he wasn't actually. I never used that. I just, every time somebody writes me a letter that is critical of English, some English construction, I think of the guy with the Tums.
I do still have a bugaboo, and I guess it's because I'm old-fashioned about ending particularly a headline with a preposition.
Oh, ending a headline with a preposition. Yeah. Well, I can see how that could be, but well,
I see more and more of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's because, Ira, as you get further and further into your well-deserved retirement, there will be more things that older people used to do that they're not doing anymore. And that's, by the way, how English changes, don't you know?
I was going to say, like reading the paper.
Yes.
No, but that's how English changes.
Yes.
Evolves. You know, people evolves, and then stuff that would have been thought unthinkable ends up in the dictionary and like that.
Yep.
For example, the word ain't. I love the word ain't. It gives you sort of, you know, emphasis on something. So if you're writing a column and you say, that ain't right, okay. Now, you're going to get letters. You know you're going to get letters, but it adds a certain amount of emphasis.
Mm-hmm. And it's understood, I think, that it's used colloquially when you put it into a column, but
well,
it still hasn't made it into the...
Well, there are people who didn't understand it. Trust me on this.
You're probably right. Anyway, on to further issues here. One issue that's arising comes from a rather remarkable book that had its first presentation as a New York Times Sunday Magazine piece. It's a book by Matt Bai, that's spelled B-A-I, who is a Times, actually a former Times reporter, now at Yahoo. And he wrote a book called All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. It's really a book about Gary Hart, about that remarkable time when Gary Hart was cruising toward the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party, was far ahead in the polls, when suddenly he was upended by the reporting of the Miami Herald.
Now, in this case, upended is a very good and pointed point.
Not even talking about Kim Kardashian.
It was something that basically found that they staked out his apartment and found that he had apparently been in his apartment overnight with Donna Rice. So the point that Mr. Bai makes in his book is that this potentially deprived the American people of what might have been an epical presidency, that Gary Hart was uniquely qualified in making different points than any other candidate for the president at that point, and that it changed journalism forever. The notion that journalists need to go after this private stuff in a person's life.
And why do they need to?
As opposed to public.
Because the public wants it. It's what we call titillation.
Oh, you're not supporting that, are you? By any
no,
chance?
I'm just trying to explain what this is all about.
Uh-huh.
My job as a political scientist, you know, is to tell what is as opposed to what should be. Sometimes I do what should be.
Well, you were going to raise the point, I think, that portions of the book, a correction has now been made in the New York Times' account of that book. It was a New York Times Magazine story because of complaints by a couple of the principals from the Miami Herald. And so there was the question was whether the correction was valid, why did it take so long, et cetera. I was going to ask you guys if you think the point that you were making, which is the Miami Herald reporting about the alleged affair that Gary Hart was having with Donna Rice, which was unusual and had not happened through all of the years with FDR and JFK, was that the proper tact to take? Was it appropriate for a newspaper to look into that and report it?
Well, Ira, you're right on the money, because the issue was, when did Gary Hart say, and this was always the justification for it, you can follow me.
Right.
That is the point on which the correction turns.
Right. That's right.
So, that's one of the two issues here.
So there's the general consensus was that he said it, they did it, and he got caught. Nevertheless, that seems to be a bit of historiography, and maybe that wasn't true.
what Matt Bai says in his book is that, in fact, that phrase had not been seen by the Herald reporters when they made the decision to stake out the apartment. And now one of the people involved, Tom Fiedler, who was then one of the editors in the project, became the editor of the Miami Herald, says, no, no, we had seen it. We had seen an early edition of it. Seems to me to be a very minor point in the broader context that Ira's raising of whether it was the right thing to do and whether, in fact, today it is the right thing for us to do, to follow around.
And would it be happening today had it not happened at Gary Hart? Did that open the floodgates?
Well, look, the Sheeny is not going back in the bottle. This is the way it is. They're going to do that now. And I'm not impressed with the argument because from a historical perspective, we know now that everybody in America believes that Gary Hart challenged him. He was stupid to do it. And they went after him. So now it turns out maybe that wasn't the case. And that's very important for the historians, but it doesn't do a darn thing to change the way things are.
I think that's right. The genie is out of the bottle. It's not as though now we would not be reporting. I mean, obviously, look at the response to John Edwards. It was a tabloid, the National Enquirer, who tracked down him in a hotel room with the woman who would later bear his child.
But you have Bill Clinton, who is probably the poster boy for this, went through all of what he went through, did whatever transgression he did, is generally acknowledged to have been a very good president, one who got reelected. And the point with Gary Hart is, had this not occurred, he very likely would have been elected president and the world would have been entirely different.
Oh, come on, Ira. Woulda, coulda, shoulda, maybe.
Well, wait a minute. Yeah, what part of that do you disagree with?
I disagree with the assumption that if he had gotten elected, things would have been different.
Okay, but the point is that had they not reported this Donna Rice story, it's likely that he would have, in fact, been elected.
Like they didn't report two outstanding historical figures, Dwight David Eisenhower and the Summersby woman.
Exactly.
And as my mother used to say, when she didn't approve, the word woman comes at the end. And also, you know, FDR and his stuff. And by the way, the stakes were so high in that one, I have a feeling nobody could have and nobody would have dared.
So the assumption is that we'll never go back to that day. We'll never be back at a time when the media will not report on this sort of thing?
Well,
or is it becoming so widespread a practice?
Yeah,
that is, adultery is not, well, I don't know if it's more widespread than it used to be, or is a person's sex life now again going to be considered, well, it's not a big deal because after all, we reelect people after they have had huge explosions. Look at Senator Vitter of Louisiana. Look at the governor of South Carolina who went on his supposed trek into the mountains.
Well, you can look at it also in this state. Now, Governor Cuomo is not committing adultery. But he is living with someone with whom he is not married. Now, that would not have been accepted as recently as what, two decades?
No, as recently as now, when a major cleric within his church says that this is terrible. And how about all of the actors? There were times, believe it or not, that people in Hollywood and others would have been severely castigated. People, there would have been movements to take them out of their studios and not to go to see their films because of it. Now it's almost a positive.
So then to the point of not putting the genie back in the bottle, it's possible that this kind of thing may not be reported going further because it will become more accepted in society and people will just shrug at it.
Maybe.
Well, remember, this is a very conservative country in many ways. Rex can tell us more about that than anybody because he comes from that part of the country. but in fact, you see that tension that exists between the so-called liberal community in this country or permissive people and the people who just say, you know, that's terrible. I would throw my husband out of this house if he did that. And there are a lot of those people. And in the last election, I think we saw a lot of them.
All right. Interesting conversation. If you want to join it, media@wamc.org. Join us for the talk. We're going to talk a little bit about the environment and coverage of right now. The New York Times has just announced that it has added an editor and three reporters to focus exclusively on environment coverage. This is just a year after dismantling its environment desk. And the science editor, Barbara Strau, is quoted as saying, "The idea is that climate change is the biggest story going, and we ought to be on it in a big way." Contrast that, folks. NPR, the number of content pieces tagged environment that NPR publishes has declined since January. Interestingly enough, NPR has cut back the number of staffers focused solely on the environment and climate change. NPR now has just one reporter on that topic.
We got a new president of NPR. I think his mandate is to make sure that the company runs in the black. And we've been getting tons of mail here about NPR's decision to accept basically for pro-fracking propaganda material on their underwriting announcements. We have been hearing from one person after another. They always end, think about it. And then we have to explain to the people who are writing in, Rex, that it isn't us, that it's NPR, which is completely separate.
Well, under the heading of Misery Loves Company, I must confess to have been derived a bit of pleasure reading about this NPR decision after how many years of us sitting around at this table and in our own boardrooms bemoaning the fact that daily newspapers have been cutting people and have been forced to reduce coverage as a result. And, you know, organizations such as NPR have been held up as above the fray. And guess what? They're not above the fray. And I, you know, who knows what kind of choice they had to make at some point when they had to start cutting, if they had to start cutting, for them to have said, we're going to cut our environment coverage, what did they decide not to cover? Because the environment and climate change, it just seems to me, is going to become a bigger and bigger story as the years go along. And that's not a place where you don't want to be covering right now.
Well, but Ira, to be fair, as you know, as a publisher and an editor, there are always choices to be made.
My friend Mr. Smith and I have been saying that here, and you've been chastising us, lo, these many years. Yes, I sympathize with NPR at the same time that I chortle a bit, because NPR has always been held as above the need to make these kind of financial and coverage decisions.
Well, I've done better than that. I have never felt that NPR is a paragon of virtue, and I've certainly made that clear here. And the contest between the member stations and the NPR brass, I've often talked about Robin Hood, stole from the rich, stole from the poor, and kept everything. And and that's NPR. So I think you take liberties with my position, Ira.
The challenge...
Didn't mention him by name, but he presumed that that was his
indeed.
Position.
The challenge that we're going to be confronting, I think, as the environment and in climate change conversation goes forward is this, that it is now becoming a partisan issue, that an awful lot of people elected to Congress, indeed in positions of authority in the next Congress, are people who are, in fact, climate change deniers. And many of
the Environmental Committee in the Senate.
Exactly. And many of us in journalism have said that we are not going to be as understanding of climate change deniers because, in fact, they are standing up against science. It is a tiny, minuscule fraction of scientists who do not believe that human endeavors are changing the climate. I have said previously, publicly, I've written a column about this, that the Times Union is not going to give equal weight to the climate change deniers that we give to science. It's as though the climate change deniers are the people who thought that the Earth was flat in the 15th century when Christopher Columbus sailed off. Yet we now are finding that a lot of people in positions of authority in Congress are going to be in that tiny group that really are not ascribing to science. It is going to be very hard for us to figure out how to cover this stuff, right?
Well, yes, and I think there's a political aspect to this too. And you guys may end up helping the Democrats more than you think, because if your position is that strong on that issue, I am sure that Imhoff will be making some of these statements and the Republicans will be making some of these statements, and that the Democrats will be having a field day with them, because the American people clearly understand that there is such a thing as climate change. And if you take that position and are cautionary to the folks who are saying it, it will help change things.
But it's going to be very hard, because readers who are inclined to ascribe to a Republican preference are going to be unhappy if we hold to our standard of believing that science trumps politics in this, and that we need to not cater to those who deny the reality of science, which I believe in my heart many politicians are doing, that they are cravenly going after points of view that are not squaring with science.
Well, you know, Rex, people make mistakes in politics all the time. The Republicans, for example, made a tremendous mistake with women in the Obama election, and they all scampered to change that position, and it worked to some degree in this last round. So if it doesn't work, they change. And I suspect that may happen here, too. We've seen it with that. We've seen it with the war on Hispanics, which has been deeply resented by so many. And we see them trying to make changes there. So you never know whether the light of day and newspaper exposure will change all of that.
Yeah.
Well, the other dynamic, and this is less media than it is policy, but in light of the agreement that Obama made with the Chinese president on limiting gas emissions over time, one of the responses prominently from John Boehner, in fact, it was in today's New York Times as we speak, was that this is going to be a jobs killer. In other words, that there are so many industries in this country and in some of the districts.
We're making money from polluting.
In effect. I mean, he didn't quite say it that way, but he didn't even deny the concept of climate change so much as he said, if we're going to do these things that are going to eliminate the jobs, I can't be in favor of it.
And of course, they did the usual things. The right wing did the usual thing and said, well, the Chinese didn't even agree to do anything for the next umpty-ump years, and we have to do it right away, and that's wrong. So there's always a way of, you know, sort of...
Well, they may well have a point there, but at least they're cracking the door open slightly, which is, in effect, it's better than nothing.
Speaking of China, by the way, there was a great deal made by the president and the president of China about the agreement to ease visa restrictions for businessmen, students, and tourists. But what was pointed out by a question from a New York Times reporter and subsequently reinforced by the Times editorial board is that while they're doing that for businessmen, students, and tourists, the question has to do with foreign journalists. China has stood in the way of giving permission to work in China to journalists who have written legitimate stories raising questions about how China's government operates.
Well, if you give them to the foreign journalists, you have to give them to the domestic journalists, too, and Rex, and that's the last thing those folks want. I mean, we have a flawed democracy. There's no question. We make major errors in this country. We let the legislatures draw their own districts, for example, and, you know, and then create a very bad image of what American democracy really is. Nevertheless, it is a fairly free press in this country, as opposed to a place like China, because once they let that go, the doors open, they're done.
Absolutely. And we are marvelously free by comparison. And the point that is made here is that China is basically trying to have it both ways, standing up with Barack Obama and making it appear as though they're being open to enable businessmen and students and tourists to come and go freely. Mm. But in fact, they're trying to restrict coverage that allows people to see the oligarchs of China truly on display, or how the country's powerful elite display the landscape and rob from the people. It's and that kind of coverage is the stuff that we expect our journalists to do here, but which China is not secure enough to allow.
I hate to say this, Rex, but right you are.
Do you think there's a certain inevitability, however, that this is going to change? It has to change over time. I mean, we just went through the anniversary of the toppling of the Berlin Wall, and if I remember my history correctly, a lot of the credit for that whole episode was the favorable influence or the democratic influence that was provided by CNN.
You're right. Look, Ira, you're right about that. But the fact of the matter is the Soviet Union was a failing enterprise. It was a failing enterprise. It fell on its own weight. And that's what that was really all about. I'm sure you're right. There were peripheral help from CNN and the others. But I got to tell you, I don't think that's what was really going on here. Now, China is one of the strongest economies in the world and getting stronger. And they say they're overtaking the United States and will be there. So that's a very different story.
But it is still going on. CNN is no longer going to be broadcast in Russia after the end of the year because there are new media laws in Russia restricting how it can be done. And so all around the world, there are such restrictions that a huge proportion of the globe is not getting real journalism. They're getting doctored, cleansed stuff.
Well, I think that they'll miss CNN, but they won't miss Wolf Blitzer.
Take your shot.
Stand by.
Stand by. Something big is coming. Something big is coming. Absolutely. All right. Well, we're going to have to let that be it for this week, and you'll go on to...
This program should be an hour.
Well, you know, what can you do? We have much to do in that span of time. Folks, we appreciate you joining us. The professor, the publisher, and the editor, Alan Chartok, Ira Fussbell, Rex Smith. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week on The Media Project.
Don't blame me. He's the one who doesn't want the hour.
Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's aunt. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.